session. We have three bills up today. The first one is House Bill 2247 for a public hearing only. I'll ask, I think we have a couple of people in the audience that want to speak to that. If they'd like to come forward, I'll have counsel explain the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2247 replaces certain landlord-tenant statutes with revised and shorter statutes. It's my understanding that it's an attempt by LC generally to clean up this area of the statutory, of the statutes.
Fine, thank you. Whomever wishes to testify first may state their name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I'm a lawyer with Lane County Law and Advocacy Center with office in Eugene. I work on behalf of low-income tenants. I work in this area of landlord-tenant law and have since 1977 when I got out of law school. The Landlord-Tenant Act was adopted in 73. It has not been amended significantly since then without first being negotiated by a coalition of landlords and tenants. And that's been true since the early 80s. Since the early 90s, there have been two coalitions. One, a general coalition of apartment landlords and tenants, and a second of manufactured housing landlords and tenants. 2247 is intended to be a neutral rewrite of two somewhat identical, but not quite, abandoned property statutes, existing statutes, ORS 90.425 and 90.675. At this point, I've written about two-thirds of both of those statutes. So I'm the guy to blame, although I'm doing it at the bidding of the two coalitions that I work with. I am the principal tenant negotiator in those coalitions and the principal facilitator and drafter in those coalitions. I would be the first to tell you that both of those statutes are too long and too complicated and that they would benefit from being rewritten. But this is a very complicated area of the law. It starts with what is abandoned property in the beginning. Is it a box of half-eaten cereal, or is it all of the tenants' clothes and furniture? What does the landlord do with that stuff? Does the landlord get to sell it, throw it away, keep it, and use it? How does the tenant get the stuff back? What happens if there's a single tenant living alone who dies? What happens if it's an abandoned pet? More to the point here is what happens if it's an abandoned manufactured home, where the tenant owns the home and rents the space and was evicted, because that happens. Some manufactured housing tenants do get evicted. If you get evicted and you own your manufactured home and you can't sell it in the park, it's very hard to move it. It's hard to find another park that will take it. It costs a bunch of money to get somebody to move it. Those homes are sometimes worth tens of thousands of dollars. They have mortgages. That means that they have banks who care about them. And some of them own back taxes, which means that county assessors care about them. In 1997, in the legislature in that session, the banks kind of woke up and said, whoa, you mean my security could be treated as abandoned and thrown away or sold? So we, through a coalition, negotiated. Those statutes were probably doubled in length to address the fact that there are other interests besides landlords and tenants. There are banks and owners of those homes. We would support amending these two laws to make them simpler. But this is a very complicated area. It's hard to do it in a neutral way. And we don't want this bill to happen now. We are, as coalitions, both coalitions, committed to working on doing that in the interim. But we're talking about months of meetings. The Manufactured Housing Coalition has 19 members. It's hard for us to agree on what day to meet, much less on the substance of a statute. And these statutes are very complicated. There are interest groups here who don't like the way it is now and would love to change it. But our point mainly is that there are, in this attempt by LC to write it clearer and simpler, there are some substantive changes. And we need to understand those changes, and some of those changes we will not agree with. I don't think that LC intended to change the substance. LC intended to make it a better statute, group of statutes, and we support that intent. We just can't make that happen this session.
Thank you. We gladly support your invitation to have this negotiated at another level, and that's the reason why we're only having a public hearing today. Mr. Miner?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. John's work in this area goes back before mine. I've only been working on the abandonment issue since about 83. As John correctly said, this is a very complex piece of law. It's way too long, hard to read, although those that work in this area regularly, I think, have a very clear understanding of it. The cause of it being so long is just the negotiations that go on between folks. If somebody gets something and somebody loses something, the players in this involve banks, consumers, manufactured home retailers and factories, park owners, county tax collectors, county assessors, just goes on, consumers, the homeowner, I wouldn't want to leave them out. And like John, we'd like to see this set over until the interim where there's more of a chance to work on it, get folks together. And I'll conclude my remarks there.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you again for your position in trying to resolve this at another level, because the idea of, as the witnesses say, you know, abandoning the property and having various persons and entities claim rights and interests and having those priorities straightened out is very, very technical and complicated. And we appreciate your effort in helping us.
Mr. Chairman, we had had a conversation with my chair, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Hendricks, because I had some concern of 20-some bills that came forward from legislative counsel as to how much substantive change are in that and how much is just a little wordsmithing to make things, may, you know, shall and may and will or will not, whatever, you know. So we're going to be taking a look at most of those bills, and I would just guess that this time is probably the last day you're going to see this.
Fine, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2247 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2256. On that measure, I believe we have zero participants from the public. Does anybody wish to testify for or against this measure in public hearing? If not, I will close the public hearing and move to work session. Discussion on this House bill. I should have asked counsel for an explanation. I'm sorry, I kind of jumped too fast on this. Why don't you give us an explanation, counsel, and let us decide what to do.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2256 is another bill from LC. This one is, from my understanding, just wordsmithing. It's relatively short, and it identifies provisions to which definitions apply.
Is your opinion, counsel, these are just housekeeping changes? There's nothing substantive, no substantive changes here?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Discussion? From the committee. Hearing none, I intend to bring this to a vote at this time. Clerk will call a roll. Well, I need a motion, don't I?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 2256 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Further discussion from the committee? Hearing none, then the clerk can call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Word? Excused, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me?
Representative Word is excused?
Yes.
Thank you. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, Measure 2256 is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I'll request Representative Girard to carry the bill, and perhaps Representative with consideration for placement on the consent calendar when we reach the full committee. Okay, the chair will open the public hearing on House Bill 2213. Counsel, do you have an explanation, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2213 removes requirements that the district attorney or division of child support provide withholding services when the obligee or the spouse receiving support payments is due only spousal support, as opposed to being due both spousal support and child support payment. It also removes the requirement that the DA or DCS provide the services necessary to establish support payment record.
Thank you. I have one witness in favor and one witness against. If both of you would like to come forward and have the proponent speak first, Ms. Schenkel.
Chair Ackerman, with the committee's permission, may I bring a couple of other people from the child support program as well?
Sure.
Back up.
Yeah. You seldom needed help in the past, but we welcome the participation.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office, here to testify today in support of House Bill 2213. I'm planning to give you just a real brief overview of the issue from the department's perspective, and then I have brought with me today, in case you have specific technical questions for the child support program, Shaney Fuller, who is the legislative liaison to the child support program, and Conchetta Schlesinger, who is the child support liaison from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. So they're my backup if you want to talk about details. Staff is passing out written testimony. I will be brief and not go through all of it, but I just want to, by way of background, tell you that this legislation is brought before you today, and I understand that upon first reading of the bill, it's not real clear. So let me tell you the intent, and then we can look at the text of the bill, and you can see how Legislative Council has done that. Quite some time ago in Oregon, when you implemented the income withholding laws, at the time, based on services and resources, language was put into Oregon statute that included doing income withholding on spousal support only. So currently in Oregon law, we provide income withholding services through the child support program for both, obviously, child support cases, and for child support cases where there is also spousal support, but there is a third tier in our existing law, which is spousal support only. So no children involved, but mom and dad divorce and one assistant with the spousal support. That's the focus of our bill today. That is not a federally mandated function of child support programs, and in fact does not qualify for our federal matching rate when we choose to provide those services in Oregon. And so we are looking at asking you to make the policy choice to change the law to make that optional rather than mandatory for the child support program, to leave the ability, should there be resources, to provide that service, to continue to do so, but to remove the requirement to have to provide that service so that we can focus our efforts on our primary mission, which is serving children and families. That's the basic point of the bill today, and then I'll show you some information to sort of bring you up to speed since this is the first time before your committee. Attached to your testimony, you have behind it a real brief organization chart of the child support program. And if you would turn to that for a moment, you'll notice that Department of Justice is at the top because in Chapter 180, you have designated the Attorney General as the state entity responsible for oversight of the Oregon Child Support Program. The way that works is that he then has his Division of Child Support administer the overall program. They provide child support services, as you can see in the boxes below. But we also contract with 28 of the 36 county district attorneys who provide child support services as well. So the program is still, in fact, both a state and county joint effort when we talk about this bill, and these services are provided by both the state and county child support offices. The other thing in speaking with Chair Ackerman that came to our attention is that we should provide you, because of some legislative council amendments that are also in this bill, with a real basic information about program structure and the statute. So on the back of your organization chart, you'll see a copy of two statutes. One is Oregon Revised Statute 25010 that defines the term administrator. And as you will can see, administrator means both the staff within the state program, the Division of Child Support, and the staff in the county district attorney's offices. It's a general term used by legislative council consistently throughout the statutes rather than having to list all of the players over and over. So if I could take you to the bill now, You will notice that in Section 1, where the proposed amendment to 25381 resides, that one of the first changes is simply that legislative cleanup using the term administrator rather than the long string. That is not a substantive change. That is just ongoing effort by legislative council for consistency in language. It's further on in that section where you see the first substantive change, where we're deleting the words, including services necessary to establish a support payment. Support payment broadly means both child support and spousal support, and instead specifying payments for child support. That's where you see our request that we are only required to do income withholding on child support or spousal with child support. And then there is additional information further on. Again, federal law does not require us and does not fund us to do the spousal support only. However, the Attorney General acknowledges that that is an important policy issue for the citizens of Oregon, and we have had some contacts. He has had some contacts from advocates that are divorced parents, ex-spouses who are interested. That's why you'll also see in Section 3 some language proposed for your consideration that makes a policy statement that says spousal support is important, and the courts and the Oregon government should consider that an important factor, which is something that the advocates could point to in Oregon law and say Oregon values it. It may not, however, be a service that they can receive from the child support program. It may be a service that they need to get through their private attorneys. In my written testimony, as you can see, in the caseload, which the child support program has about 250,000 cases statewide, out of that caseload, as of May of last year, when we took a snapshot in time and we were looking at this legislation, you can see that there were 1,258 spousal support-only cases at that time. And there's an estimated cost for just the general work that it takes to set up a system to allow the income withholdings to go out, the postage and the phone calls. It's not a high level, a full level of services, of course, but it does take some resources away from working other cases with families, so it's simply a shift of resources. I think I will leave off my explanation testimony at that point, other than to say we do have Conchetti here, because the Oregon District Attorney Association is in support of this legislation as well. Many of these cases, since they are in essence private cases not involving state services, fall within their part of the caseload, and so they are in support of making this an optional law rather than a mandated service, and she's available to answer questions, as is Shaney. Shaney Fuller has been working with Sybil Hebb, who will testify next, I believe, on some of the concerns, and I just want to alert you, Chair Ackerman, and members of the committee, that with regard to their issues, Ms. Fuller advises me that if you wish to carry this over, we certainly think that we can get to a compromise amendment. Our intent is one and the same, but clearly we haven't reached the language that satisfies everyone's needs in this area. So I will finish with that unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions of the committee to the witness. Representative Girard.
I kind of peeked at the Oregon Law Center's, you know, and they say that this is in violation of federal law. Would you respond to that?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Girard, I pointed that out to Sybil, but I think that is somewhat of a strong statement in that our attorneys do not see this as a violation. I think what she is going to speak to, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, is wanting to ensure that anytime we make a change in the statute, there's not an implied change in the underlying child support income withholding, and I'll let her speak to that. As long as we are in agreement, I believe, as long as we maintain income withholding for child support and spousal when it is with child support, that we will be in compliance. But they don't agree with us that this language clearly does that at this time.
Okay. Further questions from members of the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schenkel, what's the relative volume of activity between child support withholding as compared to spousal support withholding under current law?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, while I can't tell you a percentage, you can extrapolate based on the snapshot in time that out of 250,000 cases with only 1,000 being spousal support, it's a fairly small portion, and presumably that would then flow to our income withholding statistics as well. We do far more income withholding on child support cases than we do on spousal support. Nonetheless, those cases do take some resources away from serving our families.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm following along the same lines as Representative Girard. I've been in touch with former constituent of mine who's got a spousal support order from a neighboring state, and her ex-spouse is apparently in Oregon, and so trying to get that enforced. And so tell me how a spousal support decision is any different legally than a child support decision.
Chair Ackerman and Representative Worth, I'm not an attorney, number one, and we have some attorneys with us, but legally the judgment is not different. It is entitled to enforcement. What we have before you today is simply a question of who provides that service. And obviously there are many spousal support judgments in the state of Oregon that aren't coming into our system because those mothers and fathers, well, those husbands and wives, I should say, are handling those through their private attorneys in the court system and not choosing to come to us. It's a small number that comes into our system. That remedy will still be available. And should resources allow, this remedy, this service may still be available through some portions of the child support program in the future. We're simply trying to shift where the service occurs, not take the income withholding remedy away. There is an ability to do income withholding through a court action, if that answers your question.
Okay.
I'm gathering that we may have been working during the interim with your same constituent, quite possibly, if it's a California case.
Yes.
Yes. And we have worked closely with her.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I have one question. I was trying to spend a lot of time on this with her, and I asked the hearings officer, the hearings board officer, I said, because they hear, you know, disputes of child support, and so I asked him, well, what would happen in a spousal support judgment? Would you hear that? And I think the response was, well, a child support judgment is a legal decision. Spouse support is between you and your ex-husband. So you are saying, though, that the judgment is no different in legal standing.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, that's correct. The difference is under the current services in Oregon, it does not flow through the administrative hearing process, so they probably just don't have familiarity with that portion of the law. I think it's over in Chapter 107. Is that correct, where the spousal support would be?
Correct. Thank you.
Fine. Further questions from the committee? I have a couple. The way I originally thought the bill was set up would be to withdraw your authority to collect spousal support. Your testimony says now that would be discretionary with the department. Can you point to the language where you get that discretionary authority? Because I thought you were pulling all of your authority.
Chair Ackerman, thank you. If you don't mind, I think I will defer to Ms. Fuller, who helped with the drafting and legislative council, and have her show you the specific language that does that.
Yeah.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jamie Fuller with the Oregon Child Support Program with the Department of Justice. Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, your question is answered actually in the attachment that we provided to your testimony with the statutes that are set out in Chapter 25080. There you'll see in Paragraph 4, Section C, it says that we shall enforce spousal support when the obligee is living with the obligor's child. And then in Section D there, you'll see may enforce any other order or judgment for spousal support. And that is the discretionary language that we are pointing to. 25381 had shall language in it where we were saying that that was mandatory, and that's the piece that we are taking out. But we have 25080 to fall back on in that it is discretionary.
So 25080 is staying, and what we're looking at, I just was trying to follow your testimony, 4C?
It is, the discretionary language is in 4D.
4D, okay. Okay, I see that now.
Okay.
Thank you. Let me ask another question. What happens to the savings that are generated if we pass this measure? Is that just absorbed as a deficiency within the department, or is that going to go someplace?
Chair Ackerman, I guess the program would not see it as a direct savings, but a shift of resources. Currently within the program, because the caseload remains high and the resources, as you're aware, have not grown for several years, they're not getting to all of their work. They have prioritized work. So by not having to set up these cases and take some of these phone calls, that would free them up to work some of their child support services that they're not getting to. So it's a shift of resources rather than a pure savings.
Okay. Thank you. And what criterion, then, would you follow if the measure passed to continue to enforce your discretionary enforcement of some spousal support orders? Do you have guidelines or regulations in mind?
Chair Ackerman, again, if I might defer to Ms. Fuller, I believe they've talked about what we will do with existing cases in the system, and then Ms. Fuller and Ms. Schlesinger might want to talk about the optional services in the future.
Mm-hmm. Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, we have talked about implementation and what we would do with those 600 and in some cases that we currently have on the system. And we would continue to allow money to flow on those cases where income withholding is in place. And it would just be at some point in the future, if they needed income withholding, we would no longer provide that service at some point in the future. Some district attorneys, depending on their resources, may choose to provide those services, and we have committed to providing accounting services on those if the district attorney office chooses to do that. And otherwise, I would defer to Conchetta.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Conchetta Schlesinger, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I would just say that I concur with Ms. Fuller's analysis of what would happen with the cases in the future.
Let me see if I understand that. If we pass the measure, would the existing cases be serviced, the existing spousal support cases be serviced to their conclusion, or do you just withdraw and leave those cases to other means for collection?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, we would be continuing services on those cases. We would not automatically withdraw. So long as payments are flowing and we would provide accounting services, money would continue to flow on the income withholding order, so long as there's not a problem on that case. What might occur at some point in the future is the obligor loses his job or changes employment. At that time, that income withholding order is no longer effective and we need a new income withholding order, and we might not be providing that service at that time.
So that would be an example under which a pending case that you have now would not be serviced to conclusion. But isn't it quite likely that, being more of a transient type society, that lots of folks are going to move from one employer to another on a pending spousal support case and then give you the justification administratively to deny further services if they get employment someplace else?
That is true, Chair Ackerman. At that time, we would not be issuing new income holding with orders.
Okay. Any other further questions from the committee?
I guess
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any kind of statistics on what percentage of divorce and separation cases in the state of Oregon end up in an award of spousal support?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, that is not information that the child support program would have because we only receive copies of the orders that involve child support. I do not know whether or not that's information that the court system captures.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Next witness, Ms. Hebb.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, and I am a lobbyist for the Oregon Law Center, which is a provider of civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. We do, the Law Center has offices across the state. We do a lot of work in the family law arena, and some of our cases involve spousal support. I first want to sort of take a few moments to describe how important a tool income withholding is in enforcing support orders of any kind, be they child support or spousal support. Where there is an income and there is a regular wage, withholding of that wage ensures regular and fairly easily accessible access to owed payments. And that is a tool for which we're very grateful to the state. It's a service that we're very grateful for and which provides a great benefit to our clients. If the state is not providing that benefit, income withholding is actually fairly complicated process, and it's very difficult for a person without the assistance of the state or the attorney, to an attorney that they may hire, to actually initiate and accomplish an income withholding procedure as an individual. And so that's a very important tool that, if the state is not providing, becomes a tool that's relatively inaccessible to the general public. And as we know, in this current economic time, many people are unable to afford the assistance of counsel, and so we would be concerned about spousal support recipients being left without the tool of income withholding in order to enforce their spousal support awards. Frequently, the cases that we've seen, at least, in which there are spousal support only cases and there are not child support cases. Usually those cases involve elderly people, and of course all of our clients are low income. And so in those particular circumstances, we are concerned about those individuals left without this important enforcement tool. So I just wanted to kind of paint that picture of concern for removing that service. I guess to go back to a question that we discussed earlier, which is sort of how this provision, this bill would interact with federal law, and I would agree with Ms. Shankle's description that we are in accordance with our interpretation of federal law, and we agree that the state is not required by federal law to provide income withholding for spousal support only cases. What we're concerned about is the way the current law reads. We're concerned that it would carve out an exception and preclude the provision of, or not provide routinely, the provision of income withholding services in any spousal support case. There are other provisions that Ms. Fuller and Ms. Shankle pointed out that allow the court to provide those services and that indicate that services will be provided for spousal support. But we're concerned that this specific provision will be interpreted to overrule the more general provisions elsewhere in the statute. And so I think Ms. Shankle is accurate in suggesting that perhaps we could work out some language by which we would both be in agreement about that particular provision. If the state were to go ahead and stop providing income and withholding services in certain spousal support cases, we would prefer that they not, because we think it's a valuable tool for our clients. But if that support service were to be discontinued, then we do think we could agree with language that would accomplish that and not be interpreted as a violation of federal law. I did want to make one other point that we have not discussed yet, and I'll draw your attention to lines 10 and 11 of the bill. And that's deleted language and the phrase, including services necessary to establish a payment record under ORS 25.164 and 25.167. An establishment of a payment record is very important when you have a support order that is not being paid. And so there may be arrears that develop over time. And frequently, our clients have difficulty in establishing and documenting exactly what those arrears are. And the service that the state currently provides in establishing what the arrears are, and by arrears I mean back-owed support. Currently, when a case comes onto the system, the state provides the service of identifying how much back support is owed. And that's a very important service because it can help a client or a recipient of support to enforce those arrears and get paid back for those arrears. And the state's certification of those arrears is really important in a client's or in a person's ability to access certain enforcement techniques, like, for example, I can't think of the word right now, but taking the money out of federal tax intercepts require that the state provide a certification of what the arrears are before a tax intercept is allowed. And if the state is not providing that service, then that client would be without the ability to access that means of enforcement. And again, the Department of Justice has pointed out that there are other provisions in the law, in Chapter 25, that allow for the provisions of these services, but the language elsewhere in the law is not mandatory, and this language in lines 10 and 11 is mandatory, and so for that reason we would prefer that language not be deleted. And I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Questions of the committee of this witness. On your last point, are you suggesting that the repeal of that language would eliminate the authority of the Division of Child Support to begin arrearage proceedings in any case?
No, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, thank you. I'm not suggesting that it would preclude that authority. I'm suggesting that it removes the mandatory requirement that that service be provided. And there is other language in ORS 25 that allows the court to provide those services. But in the other areas of the law, where it describes the provision of arrearages, it uses the word may, and it doesn't use the word shall. And in this provision, on lines 10 and 11, it is linked to the word shall. And so we're concerned about having that mandatory provision removed.
With what I understand, the determination of arrearages is one of the main prerequisites before you can get a wage withholding order.
That's my understanding as well.
You have to know what to attach or what to garnish, and you have to have a judgment adjusted or supplemented to show arrearages, correct?
That's my understanding, yes, Representative Ackerman, Chair Ackerman. I have had a few conversations with Ms. Fuller over the past few days, but have not had a chance to have more complete discussion with the Division of Child Support, and so it may be that there is a way we could come up with language on that point as well that we would agree upon, but we have not had the time to fully explore that.
Fine. Further questions from the committee? Representative Worth.
I have the same question that I asked earlier. Do you have any idea of, you know, what percentage of cases are awarded, there's an award of spousal support? And do you have any kind of a character type of the type of person who needs income withholding to get their spousal award, and the type of obliger, I guess, that typically is trying to abscond with the spouse support, and the reason we need the income withholding for child support as well as any kind of spouse support?
Sure. Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, and members of the committee, I actually noted your previous question about percentage of spousal support cases. I think it's a great question, and I don't know the answer. It is not the majority of our cases at Legal Aid, but again, all of our services are for low-income families and low-income clients, and there's probably a lower percentage of our clients that would have spousal support needs than where there is money and funds. But I'd like to provide some follow-up research and see if I can find that. I think that would be an interesting statistic to know. In terms of your second question, I think the type of person who needs income withholding is probably varied, in my experience at least. And again, I should point out that income withholding has been provided as a matter of course in up till now. And so I think income withholding is important as a means of enforcement when payments are not being made voluntarily. And there may be a variety of reasons that payments are not being made voluntarily. You know, sometimes it's because the person who owes the support needs to get a modification because that person's income has been reduced and they're unable to pay. So that happens sometimes. It also happens that people get caught up in the emotion of the family law case, and not paying the support becomes a means of carrying some of that out. And I think there's just a variety of reasons that come up. I think the sort of unifying characteristic is that without income withholding as a means of regular support enforcement, people are left without a really important tool, and the income withholding process itself is relatively complicated. So if the state's not providing that assistance or that service, and we recognize the budget concerns that everyone is having in this time, but that service is an important provision and can help people maintain their income. And for some people, that means helping them stay off public assistance. And so I think it's a full circle. The state's providing an important service that can help save money in the long run by keeping people connected to their income.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Now, if I'm correct in this, a spousal support award cannot be revisited. It's done at the point of dissolution or separation. It can't be then revised. And so the income withholding, I would think, cost of income withholding for spousal support would be less than child support, which can be revised every 2 years or with any change of substantial change in circumstances. So there's a single award made at the point of dissolution, then it can't be revisited, spousal support.
Yes, it can.
I swear. Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, I actually have to say that I know the spousal support rules changed recently, or the laws changed not recently enough that I should not be completely aware of them, but I believe it's my understanding that you can still modify spousal support awards. I don't think that it happens as often as child support awards are modified, and so I think that gets to your larger question.
Well, if you cannot revisit it, wouldn't then that be a basic assumption then it would be cheaper, or it would be less expensive to provide income withholding for a static support award than a changing one?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Worth, I will defer to my colleagues here because they provide much more of this, they're more familiar with the services than I am, but I think income withholding can, the cost involved also depends on how often the obligor moves jobs. Mm-hmm. So if you have an obligor, you know, working in a series of jobs, you have to initiate a new proceeding each time because there's a new employer whose wages you are withholding. And I guess that actually comes back to a point that I was making or trying to make earlier, which is that these are very burdensome procedures for individuals
right.
because if an individual has a difficult time initiating one withholding
right.
order, if the obligor then changes jobs, that individual is then responsible for doing another income withholding order. And so it is a process that is relatively inaccessible to an individual without resources. And so I think that's the basis for our most primary concern about this.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Representative Flores?
Thank you. Ms. Hebb, you've indicated that Oregon Law Center deals with a lot of family law cases and state that sometimes that involves questions of spousal support. Do you have any figures or percentages in regard to the number of cases that might be spousal support collection only?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Flores, that's another good question, and I don't off the top of my head, I don't know if we're tracking whether we're providing spousal support only. We definitely track what percentage of our cases are family law cases, and there are some other details that we track. I don't know if that specific one is tracked. Approximately 42% of our cases are family law cases, and so some smaller subset of those cases, of course, are spousal support only, but I will be sure to follow up and see if we have those statistics, I'd be happy to provide them.
Thank you. And a quick follow-up?
Sure.
Of the areas, three, four areas that you've indicated, you have objection, and you did indicate there might be one or two of those areas that you could come to some agreement in regard to the proposed bill. Would all of your areas be able to be resolved with some ongoing discussion and meeting?
Well, thank you, Chair Ackerman and Representative Flores, and I've let Ms. Fuller and Ms. Schenkel know this as well. I think that if the state is to stop providing income withholding in spousal support only cases, then I think we can come up with language. It seems to me that we could come up with language that we might agree upon. I don't mean to speak for the Division of Child Support, but I still retain the concern for our clients about the halting of the provision of that service because it is such an important benefit to our clients. So that would
yes
be
and no.
Yes. That's correct.
Further questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll put this question to Ms. Schenkel, although I'd appreciate Ms. Hebb commenting. I'm sure she had a thought on it. Did you consider in designing this proposal retaining withholding services for spouses who are receiving public assistance so that, in effect, the dollars that are being collected through this mechanism would be going to the state's benefit in the end because it's otherwise having to provide assistance to those individuals?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, excuse me, I do not believe we looked at that level. I don't know that there's a high number, while certainly there would be some. These would be individuals without children, so qualifying for state assistance is probably a fairly limited number, as I understand their process and their threshold, but certainly there would be some, and I do not think we've looked at that issue.
if we could get maybe a comment from Ms. Hebb about that idea.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson. I appreciate the idea. I think it would get at some of our concerns. I agree, however, with Ms. Shankle's representation that there is a smaller subset of spousal support only recipients who are receiving public assistance. I would say the majority of them are probably receiving food stamps, but still, that is a form of public assistance. And so I think that would go a way to addressing our concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Ms. Shankle, you want to close?
If I might just clarify, for some of the questions that came up, there were some great questions. One thing I do want to point out that I failed to speak to earlier is that we're targeted today because we're talking about spousal support with couples who have been married. Out of that 250,000 caseload, keep in mind that there is a large and growing majority of citizens in Oregon that were never married. We serve families that are unmarried and never will have, therefore, a divorce decree, a dissolution. And that plays into our caseload of children and families that we serve, which is probably why you see such a small percentage of spousal support cases in our caseload. So just by way of perspective, families that we serve cross a vast dynamic, if you will. The other things I wanted to clarify real briefly is that income withholding on spousal support only is not a matter of course. It's not that they send the order to us and it automatically happens. Those are requested services through application, which is different than child support. Child support laws are very strong and say that payments will come through the program, so almost all cases with some exceptions come into the program if there's child support. Further, if there's state assistance, it's automatic referral, and then finally you get to applications. So, again, child support is the first priority coming into the system. Courts order it, and it comes directly to us and gets quickly into the process. Also, to clarify, income withholding does not require arrears. Again, Oregon laws that you have passed for us based on federal laws say that child support is collected through income withholding. Whether or not you're behind, your monthly support is going to be collected that way. Arrears, of course, add to that system and may qualify you for additional withholding. But that's simply the way we collect child support, as opposed to spousal, where you would fall behind and then want our services. And finally, going back again to the language, and we prefer, from the department's perspective, that May language in ORS 25080 that says we provide enforcement services through rule, which if we haven't provided to council, we will. It is clear that we do provide establishment services on child support and child support with spousal when that is necessary to do accurate accounting and withholding. But there's a process that we use, and it's currently in rule based on the 25080 language and not specified in statute, but it certainly is a service that we provide because it's necessary to have accurate accounting records. We don't, however, represent the mom or the dad. We are a facilitator of the legal action, so we would never presume what the previous history of a case was and whether or not there are arrears without checking with the parties.
Okay, thank you. Further questions for the committee?
I have a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Can you currently apply for an exemption from withholding in spousal support as you can with a child support?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Worth, my understanding, and I'm not an attorney, but my understanding is where child support is required to be paid through income withholding unless you qualify under one of the statutory exemptions, there's not that same requirement for that enforcement method on spousal, I do not believe.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, I believe that the language of the statute, and I will check on this, is generic to support. And so it's not child support or spousal support. And so the requirement to have immediate income withholding language is in a support order, regardless if that's child or spousal support. But I will confirm that.
Okay. And quick follow-up. And if you could also find out, I think it's approximately 70% of child support awards are currently collected. So do we have any idea of what percentage of spousal support awards are currently being paid?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, I don't believe we pulled that statistic, but we can check and see if that's something we can obtain from the computerized system.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions for the committee. Before we move into a potential work session, I anticipate from the testimony and the questions from the committee that we need some more answers and we need some more work on this, so I'm not inclined to go into work session unless the committee wants to do that. On the other hand, I would like to conclude the public hearing by sort of pulling the board to pull the committee to provide to the witnesses what additional information we would need to proceed. And I want to keep you in mind, I don't want to get an information overload here and give them so much information that's not really relevant to the two policy choices. The basic policy choice is whether spousal support services will be denied these people and only reinstated discretionary at department level. I mean, I think it's a policy choice we have to make. So I'd like to keep the information that we want relevant to that policy choice. For instance, one of mine would be, again, what guidelines would you have for the closing of pending cases? I'd like to know that. And that would be my request. Chair Girard, do you have any suggestions for the group?
No, I was just going to add my 2 cents worth when you get to the point where you'd like to know where we're all kind of leaning on this bill without taking a vote. I assume that's where you were going.
Yes, but I think I need more information first. But I'm sort of leaning against the bill because I think it's very hard times out there. I have a hard time terminating spousal support services to over 1,200 deserving people.
I would agree, Chair Ackerman. I also am leaning toward a no on this bill simply because I haven't heard compelling enough reason to change it for the hardships that might be involved. So.
Okay. Just to pull you, Representative Worth,
I'm
either on if information you would need or what your position would be on the bill. If we get all, if we pull it and it's all basically no's, then we'll go into work session.
I'm also in agreement with Representative Grodd. I think what would be helpful to know is the question I asked is what percentage of disillusion cases are actually being awarded spousal support, because it's my understanding that it's pretty difficult in the state of Oregon to get spousal support. And what's the average amount that we're talking about for the spousal support? I mean, are we income withholding for $3 or, you know, I think that would be an important thing to know. And then the typical, I guess, awardee, I think, because it's my impression that it's kind of the poorest of the poor, and this is a portion of the division of, you know, your assets, so the spousal support award, so. I think there's more. If I could get those questions answered, it would help. But
if I could maybe narrow that or frame it just a little bit, I would like to know, and this is sort of a follow up to Representative Worth's statement, how much money we're collecting out of the support only cases now. And I don't care how you do that, annual, semi annual, just give us an idea of what that represents in value, lost if we terminate the service. Representative McPherson, any suggestions?
Well, I don't have a vote to cast on this sub, Mr. Chair, but I mean, it seems to me the most compelling information that's been brought forward is there's a cost allocation of $169,000 that could be saved and available for other services that's being provided for this population, and so it seems like that has merit in itself for consideration given the difficulties we have in the budget overall. The distinction that I was focusing on in the question I last asked was between those recipients of spousal support for whom this is really just a private matter, and they have the tools of, you know, judgment enforcement and garnishment that are available to anybody who has a judgment against somebody else, as distinguished from those people who are getting public assistance, where the taxpayers of Oregon end up picking up the tab for that, and it seems to me that drawing a distinction between those populations might be a valid one to pursue here. So if that were consistent with maybe the views that we're developing here within the subcommittee, that might be some area to explore.
That's fine. So if we get out if we break out the number of public assistance cases and the ones that aren't on public assistance, I think we're talking about the caseload of the 1258. Okay. Representative Flores, any suggestions for information?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that my concern would be to get the information that the panel has indicated that they would be able to provide for us before we go into work session and make
that's
the final
that's
decision.
That's my intent. Okay. Chair Krieger, I know you don't want this debate in full committee, so...
You're doing a good job.
Yeah, we're trying to clean up everything here and present it relatively good product for the committee as a whole when they meet on Fridays. So with that direction, I will continue the public hearing until we reschedule with the information that you've received, that you're going to provide for us. Okay? So the public hearing will be continued for that purpose. Further business for the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, we are adjourned.
Of course.